to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM.
Are you recording?
You are?
Oh. Can you press stop?
CKUT Radio McGill Montreal. Nicest every time. Play the road of music. It's a ball. Bojabantan says so. World of people call. All the radio McGill in Montreal can read on CKUT. Reggae music for you and me. No color barrier.
On wharves, war washed, poor. Never broke again what he said on the farm. Next day they was gone. Back by nightfall and swung in the morn. Hung by daylight, the day was long. Sweet water out the dippers, salt in the mouth of a river. Mangrove thickets, man's soul was broken mirrors. False witness, wolf tickets. Nowadays scavengers come before the wolf finish. Teeth bare, bristling, they not scared, something different. The huts was empty, cold still warm in the kitchen. Cannibal tours, they came on all fours. Waterborne, eyes like jaws. Bones litter the beach, gnawed. Crack meat out the beast claws. Cannibal tours, they came on all fours. Waterborne, eyes like jaws. Bones litter the beach, gnawed. Crack meat right out the beast claws. Drums in the hills like sunset. The gun turret swing right to left. African queen on the ship's deck. Shipwrecked European swimming with the virus. Shot out like God's semen. Fuck the world, pox screaming. Crack missions for the heathens. Boats listed from the ceilings. Smoke drifted from holes in the ceilings. The swollen chiefs sit bickering while the meat crisp. The chiefs eat children. The grease drip. The meat rich. Down here it's just the muddy creek. Bend and twist. The bry hiss. Fat running rivulets, the fire spit. Cannibal tours, they came on all fours. Waterborne, eyes like jaws. Bones litter the beach, gnawed. Crack meat out the beast claws. Cannibal tours, they came on all fours. Waterborne, eyes like jaws. Bones litter the beach, gnawed. Crack meat right out the beast claws.
Someone, you know, fix up teachers.
17 shells to semi. Got the same mind that burn pennies. It's the flow that earned me a Bentley. It came with my own personal five work Bentley. Pretty bitch with some perky titties. I heard the keys tight in the Virgin City. But that's besides the point. If I point, you gon' catch a hollow point. You proud of the choice, guys got more to better. You've seen the light at the end of the tunnel. Try me, I will be delighted to pop your bubble. Might even get your wife and your couple in the thigh muscle. I chuckle, You know my body quality over quantity. You couldn't possibly made another quantum leap. Top of the heap, ask my colleagues. Ask, you just trying to get by like Talib Kweli. All of the throne is my comfort zone. Where I'm from, if you were unknown, you better come with a pole. Live by the coals, niggas up whole. I got no love for hoes. You done know. Niggas know. You done know. I made murder sexy. Might catch me in the F430 with a dirty Pepsi. Look how early she turned messy. Topsy turvy, putting work on them job turkeys. Push the line on the ops to the time of pop. I seen a lot as a child, I was traumatized. Now it's monetized. They swore I had Masonic ties, but my eyes only recognize dollar signs. The bag I'm in now different. The Louis luggage 30,000, I was power tripping. I'm at the house snickering, counting chicken. It's sickening. I whipped the brick, now it's submissive. Listen.
Testing, testing. This is Ryan Young. You are listening to Ecolibrium. We're getting a little bit of a late start today to the show, but I'm here. So it's a beautiful, well, it's not that beautiful out, I guess. It's a cloudy day, but I kind of like this weather. It's typical fall weather. So there's an interesting event coming up at John Abbott College tomorrow at 11:45 a.m. And it's a public event, and it's also co-sponsored by McDonald Campus of McGill University. So it's Jean-Martin Fortier, who is the well-known organic farmer who wrote The Market Gardener and is the farmer behind farms like Ferme Catartin, which sells at the Jean Talon Market and in a number of other places. And he is speaking at, what time? At 11:45 a.m. in P204, which is the auditorium in the Penfield building. And it's on the second floor of the Penfield building. So you should check it out. It's going to be, I think, a good event. And he's going to speak about his farming and so on. And he's got a number of new projects coming out. And yesterday, I think it was, or the day before in La Presse, he was voted, I don't know how they came up with this, but as to like one of the Quebec influencers, you know. So he's getting a lot of publicity these days. But, you know, the key thing about him related to a show like our show, Equilibrium, and we've had him on the show before. We did an interview with him earlier this year, and it's up on our podcast page, which is the Equilibrium Radio Podcast, which you can find in Spotify, or you can go straight to the website, which is equilibrium.podbean.com. There's an interview with him there. But his key thing is, you know, doing farming at a small scale or a human scale with hand tools, not really using any kind of heavy machinery, which has, you know, all kinds of climate change implications associated with it, the emissions from the fuel and so on. And, of course, when you use pesticides or chemical fertilizers, basically you are using petrochemicals as well, which are coming, you know, from oil development all in different parts of the world, including very destructive environmental developments like the oil sands developments in Alberta. And so his style of farming, or the type of farming that he has popularized, is this bio-intensive farming on a small scale, or at least on a smaller pieces of land that you farm very intensively. Sometimes you use greenhouses and so on. But you're able to grow a lot of food on a little bit of land and, you know, all local and all organic, and also working with nature. So integrating biodiversity into your farm plan. So at Ferme Captatant, they have these, I guess maybe you call them hedgerows, in between the plots where they're growing various vegetables. And there they plant all kinds of things that birds and insects will favor. And they even put up bird houses for birds. So that approach is very interesting, I think. And, you know, there's a number of farmers that use that approach as well. Not just Jean-Martin Fortier. But he is speaking tomorrow at 11:45 in P204 on the second floor of Penfield Building at John Abbott College in St. Anne de Bellevue. And earlier in the day, because the event is co-sponsored with the McDonald campus of McGill University, he's meeting students and staff, kind of a meet and greet, on the second floor of the Centennial Center at McDonald campus, in the room CC207. So the room CC207. And if you are a student at McDonald campus or McGill, and you are on the email list for getting the mouthpiece, there is a write-up about it in today's mouthpiece, I believe. Both the meet and greet and then his talk at 11:45 at John Abbott College, which is a public lecture and it's open to the public. All right, so that's, you know, my little promo for that event happening tomorrow with Jean-Martin Fortier, organic farmer and author of The Market Gardener. And today we're going to look back at the recent COP meetings in Egypt. We're going to feature some reports from Democracy Now!, some interviews, I guess. And so stay tuned for that. And since it's Tuesday, we're going to play a song called Tuesday Heartbreak by Stevie Wonder from his album Talking Book. So here is that tune now.
Tuesday Heartbreak seemed to be unfair, 'cause you say that you found a man. Tuesday breakout, guess you just don't care, 'cause you found you another man. I wanna be with you when you're all alone. I wanna be with you when you feel you got
you know that you love her specially. Catch up, baby. Catch up with my dreams. Maybe then I could see you all the time.
And that was Stevie Wonder and the tune Tuesday Heartbreak from the album Talking Book. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. So welcome to the show once again. And recently, of course, we had the UN Climate Summit in Egypt in Sharm el-Sheikh. I'm not sure if I say that right. Democracy Now! Covered it. Amy Goodman was often, you know, covering the event or even broadcasting live from it. And she interviewed Yeb Sano, who is a Greenpeace Southeast Asia Executive Director and former Philippines Chief Climate Negotiator. And we're going to feature an interview with him now from, I believe, November 18th, where he's talking about how the COP27 agreement must keep loss and damage fund for countries vulnerable to climate change. So here that is now.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast from the UN Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. We're joined now by Yeb Sano, Executive Director of Greenpeace Southeast Asia. He was previously the Chief Climate Negotiator for the Philippines. That changed after he made an emotional plea in 2013 at the UN Climate Summit in Warsaw, Poland, shortly after Typhoon Haiyan devastated the Philippines.
What my country is going through as a result of this extreme climate event is madness. The climate crisis is madness. Mr. President, we can stop this madness right here in Warsaw.
So that was 2013. The next year, as another deadly storm battered the Philippines, Yeb Sano was unexpectedly absent from the UN Climate Summit in Lima, Peru. He'd been pulled from the delegation at the last minute. Since then, Yeb has returned to COP every year, but as an activist and a climate pilgrim. We'll talk about that. Now Executive Director of Greenpeace Southeast Asia. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! You've just come from the Climate Action Network briefing on this year's COP27, what has been accomplished, what hasn't. Talk about your deep concerns this year.
Yes, we came to Sharm el-Sheikh to demand action for the interests of those most impacted by the climate crisis. And we hope to bring justice and accountability into the heart of these talks by way of establishing a fund for loss and damage. And when we talk about loss and damage, it is because we live in an era where we have realized the limits to being able to adapt to climate change. What's happening to the negotiations?
Well, what do you mean exactly by loss and damage?
So when we talk about climate change, there is a notion of being able to adapt, to adjust, so that you don't get impacted so severely. But when you talk about not being able to do that, meaning you lose lives, you lose cultures, you lose non-economic and economic losses and damage, that is inflicted on so many communities. We're talking about an entirely different proposition here now. Communities can no longer adapt, can no longer adjust, or they have no means to be able to access resources that will allow them to do so. And then they lose, basically losing homes, losing land, losing livelihoods, and even losing entire cultures. Some islands are even disappearing. And especially when we talk about slow onset events like sea level rise, there is no recourse for the most impacted. That's why we now talk about loss and damage, and that was established as the third pillar under the Paris Agreement.
You've said that rich countries are rich for a reason, and that reason is injustice. Explain.
Well, absolutely. The kind of comfort and the kind of progress you can say that is now being enjoyed in the global north is a product of, you know, decades, maybe centuries of subjugation of the global south, including, of course, slavery, including racial injustice, including plundering resources in the global south. And so that was a product of all of that. And now, of course, including the use of atmospheric space by way of burning fossil fuels. And then the global south countries, which have the least contribution to this problem, are those who are suffering the most. It's really a simple story. It's very unfair, and that is unjust.
So you were already, as a negotiator in Warsaw, talking about loss and damage. Here you're talking about putting money into that mechanism, and that's what the whole debate is about. You had John Kerry weeks ago in an event with the New York Times saying loss and damage means liability and compensation, and that's a place we can't go. He might have modified that over the last few weeks because of enormous pressure. But if you can talk about specifically the U.S., it's a country you have called out as the largest historic emitter of greenhouse gases. What role are they playing at the COP27?
What we're seeing at COP27, in particular on the outcome on establishing this fund, is that the U.S. is favoring the non-establishment of it, that we just continue talking and spend more resources to organize more dialogues and organize more meetings so that we don't get to establish a fund. That is very blatant in the face of real loss and damage affecting many people and communities. And I still struggle to understand the U.S. position on this one, when we acknowledge, of course, the importance of responsibility, especially historical responsibility. That's why we have climate change. We're not even talking about compensation and liability here. Maybe there's something they imagine that could be a result of this entire conversation that they're really afraid of. But of course, at the heart of it is, in fact, being held liable and accountable for all of the harms inflicted on people as a result of climate change impacts. This is really basic human fairness, right? So it's those countries in the global north that have created much of this problem should be leading the way towards demonstrating the human solidarity. I think just establishing this fund is an expression of human solidarity for those who did not cause this problem but bear the brunt of its impacts. Mm.
So if you can give advice to activists, you were the chief climate negotiator for the Philippines in 2012, then in 2013 in Warsaw. 2014, you're abruptly, well, just, you don't show up. I remember when we were in Lima, because of your powerful speeches the year before, we were looking forward to talking to you, but you just weren't there. Explain why you were pulled from the delegation. 2015, you're a major activist in Paris. You go on a hunger fast for climate justice. Talk about your transformation. And since you were a negotiator, a chief negotiator, what you think the different, what kind of impact organizers can have?
Oh, when I left this job, I decided I think the institutions we have built will never be enough for us to truly make a difference. And I decided to join the people's movement to fight climate change.
Why were you tossed in 2014?
Well, in 2014, to be perfectly honest, I have never bothered to find out why. But I suspect it is because of my vocal critique of the West.
The Philippines actually often taking a line that is critical of the West, even the government. But in the end, you say that they're actually working together?
I don't have any information on that, but I think being pulled from the delegation for negotiators who are vocal against the responsibility of rich countries in this whole process, I think it happens to smaller countries, to countries that have less power. It happens. There are a lot of strings attached in these negotiations.
So you're talking about the pressures you're under as a negotiator, but what filtered through to you, which gives you a sense of how you can be most effective on the outside?
Well, I've always cared about making people understand that this is not just a scientific issue. This is not just a technical issue, and it's not just an environmental issue. At the heart of the climate crisis is deeply rooted. Is a deeply rooted broken system, and then the kind of economic world order that dominates all of us is something that we must change. And system change must be at the center of our struggle against climate change. And I think that could only be done at the grassroots. I don't think this battle will be won or lost in these plenary halls, nor in chambers of law. This will be won in the chambers of people's hearts, and therefore that will have to be done by organizing people. There is no magic wand, there is no silver bullet to this. Organizing means talking to people, organizing communities, and making people understand the root causes of the climate crisis.
So can you talk about the dangers that environmental activists face? In 2021, the nonprofit group Global Witness said it had recorded that for the eighth straight year, the Philippines, Asia's deadliest country for land defenders. Last year, it recorded a total of 29 documented killings of people defending their homes, land, livelihoods, and ecosystems in the Philippines alone.
This is a very sad reality for Filipino activists, and in particular, land defenders, most of them coming from indigenous communities. We have seen the impunity. We have witnessed the impunity. I know friends who have given up their life just to be able to speak truth to power and to defend their land. And it's shameful to live in a country such as my country that where environmental defenders are murdered, are not given the space that is necessary to truly be able to protect the environment and fight for social justice. It's sad, and it's something that the world needs to pay attention to, and many people around the world should stand with people of the Philippines in solidarity.
This week, the new president, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the son of the dictator, Ferdinand Marcos, called Bongbong Marcos, is at APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Thailand, where he's pushing other heads of state, he says, for climate change adaptation. In September, President Marcos called for climate action when he addressed the UN General Assembly. Let's watch.
The effects of climate change are uneven and reflect an historical injustice. Those who are least responsible suffer the most. The Philippines, for example, is a net carbon sink. We absorb more carbon dioxide than we emit. And yet, we are the fourth most vulnerable country to the effects of climate change. This injustice must be corrected, and those who need to do more must act now.
So that's the new president, Ferdinand Marcos, Bongbong Marcos. If you can talk about your assessment of him on climate and also when it comes to threats against activists. We know how Duterte was so devastating when it came to violence against activists.
So Marcos Jr. has a legacy to carry with him. And that part of that legacy is the is the inability and the lack of willingness to acknowledge historical responsibility for human rights violations committed by his father. And for me, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice anytime and anywhere, like what Martin Luther King Jr. said. And this failure to acknowledge that responsibility is blatant, and that would reflect on him in as he is now in power as president. And I would think that until he acknowledges that all of the violation human rights violations in the past, it would be very difficult for us to trust that he can deliver justice in any form. And talking about his climate change rhetoric, we need to see that in action. The Philippines continues to be powered mostly by coal power, and there is no indication that renewable energy, for example, will be a priority for this government. There is still a lot of coal-fired power plants being built, and we need to see rhetoric translated into action. Even if he's championing climate justice in the world, it would be very hard for us to believe that until we see real sincerity in the context of being able to espouse justice and fighting for human rights for the Filipino people.
Also, Maria Ressa's Rappler just ran a story headlined, "The Philippine Delegation to COP27 Faces Leadership Shakeup," and reported the 29-member delegation of the Philippine team finds itself without its original head of delegation as well as top officials of the Climate Change Commission. Do you know anything about what's happening there?
Honestly, no. I have not been following that particular issue. I do know that there are members of the Philippine delegation here, I see, doing the all-nighters. So I think some members of the delegation are doing their jobs really well.
You know, climate change is attributed to a lot of things, most significantly fossil fuel and greenhouse gas emissions. I understand you're a vegan now. Is that true?
No, I'm a vegetarian.
You're a vegetarian. How does that play into climate action? Why do you see that as a part of it?
Well, this is truly important because when we live our values as activists, it's really important for us to understand the big picture. And the part of that big picture is how the meat industry affects climate change in so profound ways. And that's something that I care about, although that's a very personal choice for me. Mm.
So, can you talk finally about your life as what you called yourself a climate pilgrim? Talk about what that meant when you went from negotiator to activist, the many miles you spent walking to educate people about climate change.
So, we've embarked on these special journeys. Some of them in conjunction with the UNFCCC Conference of the Parties, Climate Summits, as we call it, in 2015 from Rome to Paris, and in 2018 from Italy to Poland, over six countries. These journeys pay homage to people and communities affected by the climate crisis, and part of the intention is to be able to have conversations in every town that we pass through, and carrying the stories from the most vulnerable communities in especially in my country. And it's been very rewarding for us to exchange stories and bring the climate justice journey into the lives of people, not just in Europe where we walk through, but all over the world, where we have also inspired many pilgrimages in different parts of the globe. I truly believe that walking has a special part, and walking long distances plays a special role in making people understand the gravity of the climate crisis, that embarking on these journeys give us that opportunity to engage so many people and create a community of people who think that that every step counts. And indeed, when we talk about solving the climate crisis, every step counts.
And last question, you're the head of Greenpeace now, Southeast Asia. Can you talk very concretely, graphically, descriptively about how climate change affects Southeast Asia in general?
Well, Southeast Asia is regarded regarded as one of the most impacted regions on the earth when we talk about climate adverse impacts of climate change. We see rising sea levels. We see massive droughts affecting so many communities. We see much more devastating storms, forest fires affecting even ancient forests in Southeast Asia, in particular Indonesia. And then flooding, massive flooding, loss of lives, loss of cultures, and it's profoundly impacting people's lives and livelihoods. And what we've seen in Southeast Asia is a deep impact on the way people pursue development, and all of this are compounded into much bigger problems, and people just suffer tremendously from climate impacts. This is very glaring for the lives of so many people in a region of more than 600 million people.
I mean, it's interesting you mention Indonesia, because Indonesia had to actually relocate its capital, right, from Jakarta to on the island of Java to East Kalimantan in Borneo. A G20 was just held in Bali this week.
No, that is true. That is very telling when an entire capital is to be relocated somewhere else. We're not absolutely sure that is because of climate impacts. Of course, there are other political reasons for doing that. But Jakarta itself is flooded perennially, and climate impacts are affecting Jakarta in severe ways, and many other mega cities in Southeast Asia. So it can truly be. It can truly be a bleak picture for so many people.
As we wrap up, China and the U.S. are the biggest polluters in the world, the largest greenhouse gas emitters. What do you have to say to them?
So the U.S. and China, obviously the G2, as we call them, the most powerful countries in the world with the biggest emissions, it's really important that they show leadership on climate action. We cannot possibly succeed in creating a robust climate regime that can prevent catastrophic climate change, that can prevent us from breaching the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit, that can truly bring us into an era of a just energy transition without those two countries. So I tell the U.S. and China, please get your act together, because the world will need your leadership.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Yeb Sanyo, for being with us, Executive Director of Greenpeace Southeast Asia, head of the Greenpeace delegation attending COP27. He was previously the chief climate negotiator for the Philippines. To see all our interviews with Yeb over the years, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, as we broadcast from the UN Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Thanks so much for joining us.
And that was a report from Democracy Now! about the COP27 in Egypt. So that's all available at democracynow.org, as Amy Goodman was saying. So the Montreal COP15 is coming up very soon, and you can be sure that Equilibrium will cover aspects of it while it's going on. And it's kind of confusing, the COP27 in Egypt and then the COP15 in Montreal. What's the, you know, are these two different things? So basically, the UN's annual climate summit is called COP, short for Conference of Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. But the UN also holds a biodiversity convention, and it's called COP15, or otherwise known as the CBD COP. So the CBD meaning the Convention on the Convention on Biological Diversity, CBD. And so it holds a convention not every year, but it does this. And of course, there are these targets about biodiversity, about stopping biodiversity loss. And there was the original COP, or this COP15, I think, was supposed to take place in Kunming, China, in October of 2020. But because of COVID, there were these postponements, and it was relocated to Montreal for December 7th to 19th. So coming up very soon, next month. And obviously, the Convention on Biological Diversity is a multilateral treaty that was open for signature at the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio, in Brazil. And it was ratified by every UN member of state, actually, except the U.S., except the United States. And the goal of the Convention on Biological Diversity was to halt biodiversity loss by 2010. Of course, the goal was missed because biodiversity loss just continues to happen more and more all the time. And at the 2010 CBD COP... CBD, that's an acronym for another thing, I think. The CBD at COP in Japan in 2010, the world community agreed on a 10-year strategic plan that included the 20 HE biodiversity targets. HE, I guess, is a place in Japan, A-I-C-H-I. But of course, none of the targets were fully met. And following the 2-year COVID delay, leaders are now going to be in final negotiations on the post-2020 global biodiversity framework. And it's intended to drive ambitious actions to reverse nature loss through the year 2030, while better incorporating indigenous rights and equity. And of course, that's always been a sticking point, that indigenous people are not consulted, they're not part of the discussions, when, of course, they have every reason to be part of the discussions, and often biodiversity is better safeguarded when they are present on the territory, and especially when practicing their traditional ways of life. So... that's the situation. So that's happening in Montreal next month. Now, I found it bizarre that for this conference next month, no matter who you are, if you're a journalist, if you're a civil society person, or if you're a government representative, at this COP, even though it wasn't the case just recently in Egypt at the COP27, at this COP, they are enforcing the COVID vaccine passport. They are forcing people to test every day for COVID, I think with these self-administered rapid antigen tests. And the whole thing is a masked conference where everyone has to wear masks, and you can only take it off when you go up to the front of the room to speak. So I found it bizarre that just recently in Egypt, they had the COP27, but there was no COVID-related entry restrictions for travelers, whether Egyptian nationals or foreigners coming into Egypt to go to this conference. They just suggested or highly recommended that you be vaccinated with a COVID vaccine or booster. And they recommended that you, if you feel ill, that you get tested for COVID. And they during the conference, they set up these voluntary testing areas. So if you wanted to get a COVID test, you could. And they suggested maybe to wear a mask, but it wasn't enforced. You know, you didn't have to. And no physical distancing was, you know, implemented and so on. So I find it bizarre that here in Montreal, we're here in Quebec now, I think even if you test positive for COVID, there's actually no even isolation requirements. You can just go to work the next day if you have COVID. That's my understanding. Especially if you're asymptomatic. But I think that's the law now. There's no isolation requirements basically whatsoever. And of course, the vaccine passport is not in play or enforced or asked for in anything else in Quebec general society in terms of, you know, going to public events and so on and so forth. So it seems strange that they're doing that here in Montreal for the whole conference. And is it because China is the lead country? I don't know. Or is it because Canada made this choice? Because obviously, if it wasn't being enforced in Egypt, Egypt probably chose that route, right? Because if it was a UN policy in general, then the UN would have had it in place in Egypt and then in place for Montreal. But the two things are different, but they happen right after each other. So it really makes no sense, I think. So maybe that will discourage some people from attending this conference, especially people in civil society, indigenous people. You know, there's all kinds of people that may not want to attend because of these restrictions. And funny enough, of course, they're building a huge fence around the Palais de Congrès. I think it's already in place. That's what I read, that the police would have this in place by now. And they're closing down, I believe, the metro station, which is closest to Palais de Congrès, because they're so nervous about protests and so on. And, of course, there's so many heads of state that come to the conference, so it makes sense that they're all the security. But it certainly doesn't make it an attractive place for an activist to go or somebody from civil society because of the extreme security and, all of these COVID measures / restrictions when in the rest of Quebec society, we don't really have those right now. So anyways, that's just a little bit of information for you. So we'll obviously be covering that conference as it starts in Montreal and as it plays out. And you're listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. And we're going to play a little bit of music before we finish off with some more news and information here on Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And Felix LeClaire is one of my favorite artists from Quebec society. And he has a song called La Gaspésie. And it's all about the Gaspé. Obviously, that's a region in Quebec. And I really love the Gaspé. I think it's a beautiful area. And this is a beautiful song about La Gaspésie. So here is that song now by Felix LeClaire.
Il y a au fond de la mer des montagnes, des ravins, des villes, des cimetières. Il y a des épaves dans la mer, dans le creux, parmi les joncs aux grands doigts. Il y a des hommes dans la mer, des femmes qui dorment, il y a des enfants dans la mer, pour couvrir tout cela, il y a des vagues sur la mer, buveuses de lune. Il y a des écumes aussi, des écorces, des lettres déchirées, des fleurs à la dérive, il y a des oiseaux au-dessus de la mer, de grands oiseaux blancs, avec des yeux comme des gouttes d'eau. Des oiseaux sans voix qui tournent en rond le bec ouvert, qui piquent soudain dans les flots immenses, les ailes collées le long du corps comme deux bras qui bruissent en s'égouttant. Il y a des grèves autour de la mer, des coquillages et du sel, et de vieux marins qui ne voguent plus, qu'on a débarqués mais qui sont repartis dans des voyages sans escale. Il y a le soleil sur la mer et toi au bord qui le regarde descendre dans l'eau.
And that was Felix Leclerc and the song Le Gaz Baisi. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. So we've got a little bit of time left, and we're going to play another interview from Democracy Now!, part of it at least, about sports washing and greenwashing. And it's an interview with the ex-soccer player Jules Boykoff on Qatar hosting the World Cup and the greenwashing and other things that are going on related to that. So here is that interview now.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue to cover the 2022 FIFA World Cup underway in Qatar, where the soccer tournament's taking place in the winter for the first time due to Qatar's extreme summer temperatures. Qatar claims this will be a fully carbon-neutral World Cup based on offsetting emissions, but many have refuted that. This is Lancaster University professor Mike Berners-Lee, whose research predicts this year's World Cup will actually emit 10 million tons of carbon. He spoke on BBC Sport.
The idea that they've somehow made it green by cheap, nasty so-called offsets that just don't undo the damage from the emissions at all, you know, to become carbon neutral, that just that doesn't stack up at all.
We're joined now from Portland, Oregon, by the former pro soccer player and author Jules Boykoff, whose latest article in Scientific American is headlined, "The World Cup in Qatar is a Climate Catastrophe." He also published a piece in the open access SSJ journal headlined, "Toward a Theory of Sports Washing, Mega Events, Soft Power, and Political Conflict." What do you think is most important, Jules? I mean, you're a former athlete, soccer player, football player, to understand and for people to take away from this World Cup.
Well, I would say there's two things that we should be thinking about even during the tournament, and that is what you mentioned at the outset, sports washing and greenwashing. We're seeing both in technicolor here with the Qatar World Cup. We're definitely seeing sports washing, where political leaders are using the sports event to try to deflect attention from human rights woes at home and chronic social problems at home while trying to burnish their reputation on the world stage, thereby setting a path forward for political and economic advancement. But we're also seeing greenwashing. FIFA claiming that this is a carbon neutral type of event makes a mockery of the concept of sustainability. Carbon Market Watch, a nonprofit group, did an analysis of the stadiums and their carbon footprint in terms of what FIFA said, and they found that FIFA underestimated the carbon footprint of the stadiums by eightfold. It doesn't stop there, Amy. It goes further. Every day going in and out of Qatar, you see 1,300 flights. This obviously adds to the emissions. It's not just humans that are flying in and out of Qatar as well. The actual grass seed that was used to make the fields, both the 130-plus practice fields, but also the eight pitches that are hosting these games, that grass seed came over from North America on climate-controlled flights. And these things don't just water themselves, these fields. Actually, they require tons of water, some 50,000 liters of desalinated water every single day in the summer. And I mentioned it's desalinated, again, a carbon-intensive process. And so there's a whole lot to talk about when it comes to the greenwash that we're seeing here, as well as the sports wash of this event.
Can you talk about Qatar Energy being one of the sponsors of this event?
Absolutely. This is especially ridiculous coming out of the COP27 meetings that we just had in Egypt, where everybody around the world is jumping up and down saying we need to take urgent action when it comes to global heating. And then you have Qatar Energy, this company that has become a sponsor with FIFA, that is a big purveyor of liquefied natural gas. And they claim to be a bridge fuel between carbon fossil fuels and to the greener future of wind power, for example. But in reality, it can delay the actual move to wind power. So there's, in this moment, post COP27, there's no space for the kind of petro company sponsorships on these big platforms. It is just a pure greenwash through and through.
Can any one of these giant sports events, Jules, whether we're talking about the Olympics, the World Cup, the European Games, actually ever be carbon neutral?
That's a really good question, Amy. And it's difficult to make one of these events carbon neutral, whether it's the World Cup of soccer or the Olympics, simply because of the size of these events. And rather than think about making the event smaller, listen to what FIFA's doing next. They're talking about making the World Cup field even bigger, having 48 teams instead of 32 as we have this year. We can expect that FIFA will host a 48-team World Cup and in 2026 when the Men's World Cup comes to North America. So if you were going to get serious about creating a carbon neutral event, you would also bring on independent monitors who could do audits of these numbers and offer best practices moving forward. Unfortunately, FIFA, the world governing body for soccer, and the International Olympic Committee, the group that oversees the Olympic Games, are moving in the opposite direction, getting more secretive while at the same time amplifying their green claims without letting other people who are independent take a look at them.
And this issue of sports watching, Jules, you talk, your subtitle of your piece, mega political, mega events, soft power and political conflict.
Absolutely. So one of the things that comes up when we hear about sports washing is, does this thing work? And what people often have in the back of their minds there is, does this work on an international audience in terms of deflecting our attention from some of the problems in the host country or city? But in reality, we also should be thinking about the domestic audiences. Take, for example, a recent sports-washed event in Russia, the Sochi Winter Olympics. Ahead of those 2014 Olympics, Russia passed an anti-gay propaganda law that got all sorts of attention, and rightly so, around the world for being anti-LGBTQ. But inside the country, this actually helped Vladimir Putin. He stood up to the West, the so-called decadent West, and his ratings during the Sochi Olympics went higher than ever. He actually had 86% approval ratings by the time that the Sochi Olympics concluded. And guess what? He used those high approval ratings to invade the Crimea between the Olympics and the Paralympics then in 2014. And I think that points up two really important dimensions of sports washing that are often pushed beneath the surface. And one, that is that domestic audiences matter a lot when it comes to sports washing. And two, this isn't just some mere branding exercise. This can actually be a conveyor belt of life and death.
And that was an excerpt of an interview with Jules Boykoff from Democracy Now! About the sports washing and greenwashing of the FIFA World Cup in Qatar. Or Qatar. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. So you've been listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And as I said at the beginning of the show, tomorrow at 11:45 a.m., Jean-Martin Fortier, the well-known farmer and author of the book The Market Gardener, is speaking at John Abbott College in P204 on the second floor of Penfield Building at, as I said, John Abbott College in St. Anne de Bellevue. So check that out. You can always follow us on Facebook at Equilibrium, at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUTMontreal. You can find our podcast on Spotify at Equilibrium Radio Podcast or looking for the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. And you can email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca. So thanks for listening and stay tuned for more great programming here on CKUT 90.3 FM. And we'll be back here again, same time, same place on Tuesdays. All the best. Thank you.